I'm Richard Porter.
I'm Johnny Smith.
And this is Smith & Sniff, a podcast in which two friends talk about cars and many other things.
I'm sat on the floor because I've realised I don't have an office chair because I took it to my office. And so I'm just on a plaited rug on the floor, looking like some sort of, like, you know, the Beatles. You know, the Beatles went a little bit sort of Indian, hippie spec. It's a bit, I feel a bit like that.
Or you're at Johnny's Japanese restaurant that you've just opened.
Oh,
shoes,
yeah.
Shoes off, sit on the floor, food's delicious.
Johnny's sushi, yum yum. Yeah, absolutely. There's loads of amazing pidgin English translation. It's fantastic.
Yes. Great hope brings imagination, sashimi. So you've got your new office. You actually have like a separate off-site office, or rather...
We do.
An office that's not in your house.
That's
anymore.
Right. The Late Break Show has a real HQ, which is not the kitchen table, and it feels great. It's a small timber hut, I would say, on a farm. Great view. It's Bijou, darling. It's Bijou, and it's just horses and a lake everywhere, so it's great. It's probably a bit more inspiring than the spare room, and but I'm not going to record the podcast from there because it has to maintain its authenticity. But as a result, I realised this morning I've left it, my chair and my lead from my laptop charger, and all the major things that you need in business and commerce. So yeah, I'm a bit of an amateur, but it's okay because I've got a rug around me, so it's okay.
I'm really excited for you, by proxy, to have a separate office that's not in your house, because I think for the self-employed freelancer, that's a sort of little slice of the dream. But I'm also a bit unsettled that you sent me a picture to show me how small the loo is at your new office.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I realised that you must have taken it while you were sitting trousers down on the loo having a poo.
Yeah,
and
I was.
Sort of sport my enjoyment of the picture.
I thought that.
Although I do take your point, it does look like a very small loo.
Oh, honestly, the toilet in our office, it's a new building and a new pan. It's all good, but it's very small to the point where someone's put a towel heater style radiator, you know, the big chrome tall ones.
Yeah.
But the room is, I actually measured it, I think it's 2.5 feet by 4.5 feet. So it's... so basically...
Hang on. How wide are your shoulders?
Luckily, I'm not a broad man. Honestly, if I was a rugby player and I went in there, I'd never come out. That would be it. I'd have to smash my way out through the partition walls.
I'm trying to think, who's the most broad-shouldered person I know? I can't think of anyone.
Well, all I know is that... If you put the radiator on, the towel heater radiator, bear in mind, it's an enormous radiator for a tiny room, which I don't entirely understand.
I know. I was going to say I'll put the picture up for patrons, but I won't because it depicts your legs, certainly.
Well, it's just bare legs, pants and trousers to the floor.
In the act of defecation.
Yeah, but I'm not... you can't see detail. There's no gristle and there's no brown. So it's okay.
Maybe take another picture for the patrons and we'll stick it up on the Patreon site. I did used to know a bloke who had no shoulders, and it was doubly unfortunate. He just had no shoulders. It was like he went from the base of his neck, sort of his shoulders were so sloping, it just looked like he hadn't got any shoulders at all, like a stick man.
What, like the beginnings of a folded paper aeroplane?
Yes. 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 He was like, he was like the second phase. You know, if you're doing a sort of proper paper dart, you do the one fold and then you do the second that really sleekens it out. And it was like that. He was very sleek.
He was the second fold.
He would
fold.
Have been going forwards, lying down. He would have been quite aerodynamic, I think. He could have been good at the luge.
But his jackets were always trying to fall off.
Well, worse than that, he was the saxophone player in my housemate's band. And
of
if you want to carry your sax around, you often have a shoulder strap, but this was no good to him. It was sliding off.
What? So,
and I subsequently worked with somebody who, it turns out, went to the same university as me. And I said, oh, you went to the...
Do you remember the bloke with no shoulders?
Well, somehow it came up in conversation. I said, oh, I used to know some music students. I used to know a saxophone player. And she went, did he have no shoulders? And I went, yeah.
Seriously, she remembered the same person. Shoulderless saxophonist.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My God.
The shoulderless saxophonist is a great pub.
Yeah, probably so, is, actually. It was one of the first I knew about to get the rainbow flag outside.
In the 90s, yeah, they used to do those flavoured vodkas that you just realise it was like Skittles vodka. Have you just got a bottle of vodka and dropped some Skittles in it? Yeah, we have, actually. Yeah.
Oh, awful. You get that sugar high, but with the sort of the toxic backlash of 42% booze.
Yeah.
Oh,
speaking of the 90s,
yeah.
I was in Bristol yesterday.
Oh, magic.
Oh, my God.
Sorry, I mean, mega. I'd have to say mega.
Yeah, no, mega. Wicked.
Oh, that's clean, mate. That's brilliant. Right. Sound.
We've said before, people probably know, we've said before, we've established Bristol is Britain's most 90s city. Well, let me tell you, my friend, it did not disappoint yesterday. Within 10 minutes of arriving, I saw two white people with dreadlocks. And brilliant. Moments later, I saw a man dressed entirely in Aztec print loose clothing.
Loose. Oh, I love that. Honestly,
so it's, loose, so it's, billowy. It's
such a wild, colourful pre-internet city.
Yes,
it's brilliant.
It is. So many straggly beards. Like, you realise the beard has changed over the years. The accepted style of beard and the hipster beard now is full, voluminous. Possibly with a tricksy moustache, sort of bit of styling.
Yeah.
But it is not straggly. The Bristol beard is still straggly.
I bet there's no vaping. I bet, in fact, there's an anti-vape movement. It's all
but
still
there's
roll-ups.
A lot of roll-ups, yeah.
I was going to
yeah.
say, there you go. You
and see. A faint smell of weed.
Oh, and there's loads.
I think, you know... What did you sent me a message the day when I said I was going to go to Bristol and said it's the law that you have to listen to Massive Attack.
You have
while
to.
You're actually in the city. But what I realise is, you know, they say that, like, true Cockneys, proper Londoners, you have to have been born within the sound of Bow Bells.
Yeah.
And I think in Bristol, you have to have been born within the sound of the bass line from Sour Times by Portishead. Dum,
this is true.
Dum, dum. And you just hear it at all times across the city, just faintly in the background, like it's coming from another room. Is that Sour Times? I think it is. I like this track.
Did you hear anybody's phone ring? Because maybe everyone's got the same... Maybe everyone's got Unfinished Sympathy as their ringtone. Yeah. It's never going to have the same gravitas as a song.
No, everybody looks again at their phone at once. You're in a coffee shop and... Oh, is that me?
It's ruined that anthem of the 90s.
Great track,
though.
I love.
It is an amazing track. I do love Bristol, as you know.
It's a nice place, isn't it? It is a nice, nice city. I mean, it's got a good
feel to it. It's eclectic. It's eclectic in a good way.
It is absolutely, without question, the most 90s place in Britain.
I warned you.
Anyone knows more. I know. Well, I had noticed it when I'd been there, and then you were the one who pointed it out. But going back again, I was like, oh, hello, yes.
It's just confirmed it.
It was how quickly...
I think the first time Pokemon Go was released, I was in Bristol the weekend it all kicked off.
Yeah, but they were still playing Game Boys, weren't they?
Well, this is the thing. So on the one hand, you had sort of quite international, shall we say, looking students walking around looking at phones and pointing at walls.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, whooping for joy when they saw nothing in on the street next to really confused looking people wearing army surplus gear.
That's the other thing. You know, I messaged you yesterday and just combat trousers. There's so many combat trousers in Bristol.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody's Hell got yeah. extra pockets on their trousers, unless they're Aztec print, super loose, silky ones. It's incredible. It's amazing. Amazing place.
It is an exciting city. Conurbation.
But what a handsome city as well. Very handsome city. Lots of really good buildings.
It's Britain's San Francisco, Rich.
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Because if you think about the huge scale of it, the hilly nature, and next to a good port, and it's quite cosmo in so many ways, and quite arty, attracts
yeah.
an art movement. Mm. I think it's quite yeah. San Fran.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's basically... Well,
we saw this big building at one point, really big, impressive building. And I said to my wife, wonder what that is. And she's like, I have no idea. And I bet it's not even anything important. It's just Bristol's got, like, really good buildings to spare. It's probably like a public loo or something. But they're just everything. So many really, really striking, handsome buildings.
It's probably someone from a 90s band's...
Yeah, that's Tricky's house.
Yeah,
that's
it will be. It'll be someone who's not quite well known anymore, but BBC Six Music still champion them.
Yeah.
And that's it. I can't believe we're 11 minutes into a podcast or something, and we haven't even mentioned any Cars. It's quite bad.
It's par for the course, isn't it? I'll tell you what I did see in Bristol. It's in the same area, but not in adjacent streets. I saw two Land Rover Discovery 4s, both of which had sunk so far on their air suspension, they developed massive negative camber on the front wheels.
Oh, nice.
So either they'd just not been used for a long time or they were in a state of malfunction. But either way, there were two. And they were sort of far enough apart, I think it wasn't the same person who has a Disco 4 collecting habit. I think it was just... Something else we haven't quite figured out about Bristol yet is that it's a very 90s city, but also it's a city where Discovery 4 owners don't use their cars.
Disco Slam. It's a Disco Slam. Isn't it?
That's a Bristolian lowrider.
Disco Slam.
This was in the Clifton area of the city, which is, you know, sort of very shishy, expensive part of town. And maybe that's it. Maybe there's a Clifton lowriders.
The Clifton lowriders sounds really good. And they're all in discos. And they convert them to rear-wheel drive, and they put sort of very drift-orientated negative camber on.
Drifto Disco, yes!
Drifto Disco, exactly, that's it.
Oh, well, we're on to them now.
Drift Disco would be quite something.
And would they do, like, you know, was there a trend for drift cars? They used to, well, actually for modified cars generally out of Japan, you list all of the aftermarket parts makers that you've used on the door.
Yes, you do.
But... these are just like look like standard, so it'd just be like Lucas, Bosch,
all the boring stuff.
AP, yeah, Lear Systems. They made the seats, you know. really boring, really for corporations you've never heard of that don't sound impressive. I don't know.
Rimmer Brothers.
You've identified a trend that I missed. These are the Drifto Discos. Is clearly big on the Clifton scene, because it's like, on the one hand, yeah, we absolutely love to go drifting, but we also need to get the kids and their friends in to go and see the rugby, so the disco is perfect.
That's right. Or we've also got a small holding just south of Bristol, so we must visit that now and again, and obviously the disco.
I wonder if have people gone a bit allotment crazy in Bristol, like they have. Yeah, it's sort of allotment trend in some places.
Drifto Disco allotment crazy. That's the graphic that would be down the side of it with Japanese symbols.
Yeah, it's just Japanese, just kanji writing, but it says allotment down the side.
I'd love that. And the other side,
it's just got like artisanal bread.
I'd bloody love that, artisanal bread.
See, I kept it on Bristol, but I brought a car into it, so we're okay. We're all right. I've written a list of things I want to talk to you about, and I've got quite a lot that I wanted to cover this week.
Sugar.
Just because, right. Well, talking of discoveries, I've got a correction to make, because last week I read out that thing from the Land Rover website about the Discovery 2 and said there was this what appeared to be a half-assed bit of copy that said when the Discovery 2 came out, it had a locking differential, but the connection or the linkage was disconnected. Well, that turns out to be true. I can't even list the names of all the people who've pointed this out to me on the socials and on YouTube comments and emails and stuff. But yeah, when the Discovery 2 came out, Land Rover seemingly had decided that because it had more electronics on it than the previous one, it didn't need the locking centre diff. But it still had it, presumably just because it was like easier to do that than to develop a non-locking one and risk another unproven part. So it still had a centre diff that was lockable, but had no means of locking it.
What, it just sat in the chassis, just waiting?
It just sat in the chassis. And then, I gather, sometime during that car's life, they stopped fitting a lockable centre diff because it was redundant. There was also, people realised it was still lockable and started retrofitting ways to lock it, the hardcore off-roading crowd. And then, in the last couple of years of that car's life, they reintroduced the diff and a way of locking it from the factory. So that thing on their website, although it's quite badly expressed, is actually true. So thank you to everybody who set me straight on that one.
God, I did not know that.
The other thing I was going to bring up, well, this is sort of book review corner. because I've finished a couple of books recently, factual car-based books, which I wanted to just recommend because they're both really good. The first one is Secret Faults, Volume 2.
Faults!
By Steve Saxty, which is fabulous. It picks up where Volume 1 left off. Volume 1 kind of covered the 60s and the 70s and just into the 80s. This one picks up in the early 80s and takes us right through to the Focus and that sort of era, Focus RS.
Oh.
And it's just looking at some of the design dead ends and styling exercises and experiments. There's a whole thing about what was going to be the Focus. The original plan was just to reclothe that awful Mark IV Escort.
Oh my gosh.
And they realised they had to do better. And they wanted the styling to be quite brave, but then they realised that they couldn't go as far as they wanted on that khaki old Escort.
Hang on, what Mark was it? What was the last Escort? Mark VI, wasn't it?
Yeah, did they call it Mark VI? I can't remember, because then basically, do you remember it came out? It was the Mark IV, and it was incredibly bland, and it got loads of shit for being bland. And this book actually sort of explains how that happened, which is interesting in itself. I won't spoil it.
Everyone was asleep.
Yeah. Basically, they just stuck the previous Escort on a photocopier and went enlarged by 10% and then went home. And then, they gave it, they realised it was so shit that they gave it some engineering upgrades and gave it that fish face.
Yes.
And I think maybe that's just called the Mark IV facelift, or some people call it the Mark V. I think the Mark V was when then they gave it a prettier facelift with a slender grille and smaller headlights. And
yes.
Made it much less cack to drive, apparently.
Because all these Escorts are the ones I try to forget as much as possible. All I remember is that Brian May did the Driven By You song, which Ford used in the advertising. When was that?
Yes. That was, early 90s? I think, early 90s. Yeah. So it's got all that story in
it. I bet he's still got one.
Oh, yeah.
I bet he's still
because he got it for free. He doesn't know what to do with it.
They were like, just have it as part of the contract, Brian. That's all right. I've got cars.
No, I don't want it. No, really. It's already on a lorry. It's coming over to your house now. Oh, but I'm out.
It's Burgundy. Come on. It's coming.
Yeah. It is the non-turbo diesel, I'm afraid, Brian.
The one that no one wants.
Nobody.
The one that farmers that. May or may not run on cherry, naughty cherry, yeah. Now and again.
I think Brian gets access to cherry, though, because he's got a badger sanctuary, so he can can claim it.
So on the one hand, nice, you know, conservation enthusiast, but also a bit of a naughty tax avoidance cherry runner.
Yeah, I don't think he's really got a badger sanctuary. No. But I mean, it's the kind of thing he would do, maybe.
Well, he's very busy. Enthusiastic about badger preservation.
He does love the badgers, doesn't he? Secret Folds, Volume 2, very good. My favourite story in it is that just before the Focus was launched, like about 6 months before, Jay Mays, if you remember him, was installed as the new boss of design at Ford, and he came from VW Group. And he arrived, they showed him the Focus, perilously close to production. He went, I don't like it.
Really?
And he got his main studio in Detroit to redesign the Focus using the sort of VW thinking of the time, which is, you know, very sort of tight radius, clean, simple. So it just sort of totally cleaned up the Focus, none of the little tricks and little bits of ornamentation, so it looked more like an Audi, basically. And there's pictures of this styling model in the book. But this, he did this just before the car went on sale, which I think is sort of, morale-wise, is a bit... I mean, it's a bit rude, isn't it? It's arriving and going, you know that thing you spent years working on? It's shit. Here's how you should have done it, lads. And they're going, piss off, Jay Mays. Rude bastard. So, and it actually, weirdly, the styling model looks a bit like the next Fiesta, so you could sort of see how he then just went, OK, well... Because management went, you know it's too late to change the Focus. It's going on sale next year. We've ordered all the tooling, you prick. So... he didn't get anywhere with that, but he was able to use his sort of design style in that Mark V Fiesta.
I think that's a good one. I like that Fiesta.
I thought it was a little bit sterile, a bit starchy.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't keen, particularly compared to the next one, the one that is sort of, you know, the model before we have now, which I thought was terrific and had a real sort of, you know, it was a jazziness
pizzazz.
To it.
Had a pizzazz.
Pizzazz, that's the word I was looking for, pizzazz.
I wouldn't use that term in Bristol.
No.
No, banging.
The Isuzu Pizzazz.
banging. Sound.
Fresh.
Sound
really
is
fresh.
Sweet as a nut. It'd be sweet. I mean, nobody uses that term anymore, do they? Sweet as a nut.
They don't,
sound,
no.
Mate, sound, sound.
When were those What's Up Budweiser adverts? Was that 90s?
Oh, was that? Yeah, that would have
maybe
been.
Maybe that was late. Was that sort of turn of the century?
I wonder if that. I reckon that was late 90s.
I think you might be right.
So I still think it's within the parameters of Bristolian vernacular.
Yeah, oh, almost certainly. Or they're just about to discover it with glee. And
well, there's
the
there's
rest
obviously
of the country will be
despairing. The 90s quarter of Bristol has got an archivist and a historian. They're constantly trying to dig up new material that is legitimate to use.
No, but hang on. The 90s quarter of Bristol has someone who describes themselves as a futurologist, and they're just there looking at things that came along in the early 2000s and then claiming that they're some kind of incredible soothsayer. I don't know whether you're aware of this, guys, but there's a band coming along and they're called Coldplay. Really? What are they like?
Well, hang on. Yeah, Chris Martin, he was from, or is from...
He's from that way, isn't he?
He's from Exeter, which is not a...
Oh,
not a,
okay,
it's
right.
About 100 miles from Bristol.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I don't want to just lump the whole of the South West together.
No, we can't do that. But I'm all right. I can act as the judge and jury on that one, I feel.
Yeah.
I'll let that one... But Bristol, yeah.
I just looked this up. The What's Up campaign for Budweiser started in 1999.
There you go. It is 90s. We're there.
Yeah.
We're there.
Oh, God.
We're there. Well, it's better,
anyway,
better
so,
than Oi Oi at the end of the day.
Yeah. The number of messages we've had that just say Oi Oi from people presumably trying to irritate you.
I know. It's just like listening to Radio 1 Dave Pearce era again. It just makes me... It just makes my mouth go completely straight. You know, this straight mouth emoji where it's just emotionless. Like,
what? Emotion just... But containing inner fury.
Oh, there's fury in there, within. Absolutely.
So we were in the car last night with Radio 1 on because my wife insists on listening to Radio 1 when she's driving, and I just left it on because she always starts to moan about Radio 2 that it's too middle of the road for it if they dare to play, you know, Simply Red or something.
Coldplay.
And or Coldplay. And so, actually, Coldplay get played on Radio 1 still, don't they? They're very sort of cross...
Oh, they're cross.
Cross station.
Yeah,
that's
they
the
are.
Secret of their success, I guess. But the evening, what used to be the evening session, but isn't anymore, with two sort of blithering cretins who just talk endlessly about themselves in uninteresting situations. They played this track, which apparently is on Radio 1 all the time, and my wife's heard it before, which they were going, yeah, we're going to play that one again. It's the Piano Man. It's crazy. It's mad, this track. Oh, it's so, every time we play it, we get so many messages. People love it. People hate it. It's just so out there. And then they played it. It's just fucking late 80s house music. It was like, you know, sort of dinka-dinka piano house music.
Yeah, rave piano.
Rave piano, kind of, yeah. And it was just that. Someone's brought that back. Fair enough. I love that kind of music. I thought it was a really good track. But it's like their minds were blown by it, and I suddenly went, oh, no, I'm very old.
Well, of course, in Bristol, that's still current.
Incredibly current, yes.
Yes, it's still legal tender over there still. It's just like, oh, yeah, I'll swap you 10 minutes of rave piano for a couple of bags of weed. No problem.
I should have taken with me like a compilation of trap music or something like, or grime, anything that sort of would be outside of the 90s that
parameters.
Hasn't arrived in Bristol yet. They'd have gone, what?
Yeah, well, Jungle, of course. Is still very much...
massive.
Yeah. It's the FTSE 100. Intense Jungle is on the Bristol... The Bristy 100, yeah, it's there.
You were a bit of a D&B head, weren't you? But I saw someone just describing a bit of music last week as liquid D&B. I was like, I didn't.
Oh yes, D&B.
How do you define that?
Well, it's smooth. It's smoother. I have dabbled back into D&B again. Soulful drum and bass is really good.
Okay.
Because it's
is that with vocals on it then?
Yeah, and it's just, and it's got a little bit more kind of jazz in amongst it. I think the best way to describe it would be drum and bass is acceptable to listen to during the daytime.
Ah, right.
So it's not murky nighttime material.
Yeah,
as such.
That's the thing I find with a lot of drum and bass. It has to be dark outside for it to make sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Like this morning, it's a beautiful sunny morning here.
Yeah.
If I whacked on some D&B now, I think I'd probably immediately develop a migraine.
It's too much. It's too much, yeah. Isn't it? You know, it's like those people who you see 6 a.m, they're heading to work and they've got a really chubby can of energy drink.
Yeah.
And they're chugging it and you're going, oh, bloody hell. Oh, don't know if I could do that.
Yeah.
There's a street near here
that I sometimes walk the dog down. And if I'm walking down there at sort of 8:30, there's an incredibly strong smell of weed. And I'm like, mate,
who's doing
it's 8:30 a.m. That's quite... What's the rest of your day looking like?
Well, that's just Bristolian...
Probably not busy.
That's Bristolian Brut. That's simply a cologne. It's not actual cannabis being inhaled. It's just liberally splashing hemp.
This room's very musty. Shall I stick on the old Bristol diffuser? What, you mean light a joint? Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Bristol diffuser.
Brizzy
diffuser. He's doing a night.
He's the jungle night he's got going on down by the art college.
Oh yeah, Brizzy diffuser. Don't mess with him. We were
Brizzy diffuser.
We were talking about books.
I've got another book to review just quickly. Secret Fords is great. Full of brilliant stories. Fantastic. If you've ever read any of my boring car trivia books, and that is your sort of thing, definitely investigate Secret Fords Volume 1 and Volume 2, because full of little anecdotes but also full stories of how cars we know came about but also cars we never got to see. The original Mondeo chapter is fascinating, just for how many styling models they made trying to decide what it should look like. And you realise, if you were in management at Folds, you'd have just gone, oh my God, I can't choose. This is
too
hard.
Yeah.
They're all basically similar. Like, once they'd settled on the proportions, it was just sort of fiddling with details and things. And some of them, you sort of look at it and go, yeah, that's quite nice. Or is it? And you've got to think, well, it looks nice now, but this won't be on sale for 4 years. What's it going to look like then? Oh, shit, this is too difficult. I don't know.
Just walk away.
And that was just the outside. There's a picture of the interior studio at Dunton in Essex where they did the dashboard and stuff. And there's just this arc of interior styling bucks. There must be 12 or 15 of them. And people in suits have got to walk in and go, right, let's whittle this down to one that we're going to sign off millions of dollars to have tooling made to put it into production, and we've got to sell lots of these cars or we're in trouble. I'd just have a panic. I don't know how they do it.
No.
I mean, I guess the designer's job is to sort of lead the executives by the nose a little bit, but even so, it's just like, it's mind-boggling how much navel-gazing and arse-scratching went into that car.
And also,
which ultimately arrived looking quite bland.
That's the thing,
in fairness.
At the end of all that journey, it doesn't seem that spectacular, and all that money that's been just pressure washed around, you just go, bloody
I mean, the up. Dashboard on that first Mondeo was quite good. I seem to remember at the time you sort of went, ooh, quite swishy. Although I remember it had like the buttons for things like the heated rear window. There was a button, and the symbol was sort of separate and lit up, and it always seemed a bit over elaborate. And you just went, why did you do that? Why did you put the symbol on the button? Which they then did. So,
maybe the button was cheaper at the time.
Or maybe you could use the same button over and over again and then you don't have to. Probably. I mean, Ford don't spend money if they don't have to do that. That's why they're generally quite successful. Folds. Anyway, the other book I want to just give a quick mention to is Giles Chapman's book, which I think I've mentioned before, Britain's Toy Car Wars, which I've finally finished. Not because it's hard to read, just because I've sort of had other books on the go.
It's hard to read.
It's very grey, light grey typeface on a slightly off-white page.
It was a stressful narrative that you had to keep
And it's all
down.
8 points. Yeah. That's it. It's intense. It's like reading James Joyce, but about Matchbox cars. No, it's not. It's a very easy read because Giles is a very good writer, and it's just a story of Dinky, Matchbox and Corgi, and how they once... I didn't realise this, how they bestrode the world, that before Hot Wheels came along, there weren't really American toy car manufacturers in any of any significance. And so they used to make a fortune selling cars in the US and all around the world.
Yeah.
and all made in Britain as well. Long before things were outsourced to China or Hong Kong or Macau or whatever, they were all, they had huge factories, insanely huge factories in Swansea and in Hackney in London. And they used to make millions and millions and millions of cars every year to sell all around the world, and they were hugely profitable. And then Hot Wheels came along and sort of dented their pride and their run of form, and it sort of sent them into a death spiral. But it's a fascinating story, so if you are interested,
I'm
going to
buy
that. And even if you think you're not, you should give it a look anyway, I think, because it's genuinely very interesting. So Britain's Toy Car Wars by Giles Chapman would be my book of the month.
Well, can I throw a book in
this month? Yes,
I'll throw a book in of a chap we both know, actually, who's a photographer, called Nick Dimbleby.
Oh, yeah.
Who photographs a lot for Aston, Jag, Land Rover. And he's, if you know him, he, ever since he's been a child, he's been bonkers about Land and Range Rovers. And he's brought this chunky, definitive history of the Camel Trophy out.
Oh.
It's a really big book. It's glorious. I come from the same village as him, where we grew up, but I never knew him when we lived at home. I went to school with his sister. I know this is going off piste a little bit from the book, but I remember he was in the local paper because he published a book about Range Rovers when he was 14, and there was a copy of it in our local library. Fast forward to now, and he doesn't live anywhere near where that village, and neither do I. But we know one another, and he's a very successful photographer for those brands. But he's also, he sort of collects Land and Range Rovers as a hobby. He's got some choice vehicles. But
he has.
He's
yeah.
put together this archive from 1980 to 2000, all about the Camel Trophy, where it went, all the specs of vehicles. It's got some fantastic stuff, and it's a guide to every single one of those events. And so even if you're not like a hardcore Land Rover guy, it's still really, really good. And it's be warned, it's a heavy book. I mean, it's, you could hurt someone if you swipe them with it. So I keep mine by the front door, just in case. I'd highly recommend it. And he's done a hell of a job. And that was what he did during lockdown, when photography work and sort of new car launches were put on ice. He decided to delve into an enormous archive and pull out some of this stuff. So well done to you, Nick. But also, he's a very, very nice bloke. And it's just slightly weird that I went to I sort of grew up. Well, the bus stop where I used to get the bus to secondary school was outside his house. And it was outside his house. Yeah, it was very weird. And and I remember lots of japery that went on at that bus stop, but none involved him, because I think he is 5 years older than me, which means he'd left school by the time I'd started school, pretty much. So our paths didn't cross. So yeah,
that's funny, because I just reminded me, the last time I saw Nick was in fact at a Land Rover show.
Of course it was.
Of course it was.
Course.
He only exists at Land Rover shows during the summer months.
He had,
he's got some good stuff in his little collection. So
you can find
top
him.
Top man, I didn't know about this book. That's great. I'm gonna check that out.
It's a very sexy book. And also, if you ever want to follow someone on Instagram who takes incredible pictures and has a wealthy archive of Land Rover, Range Rover stuff, follow Nick Dimbleby. He'd a man.
Well, there we go. That concludes Smith and Sniff Book Corner. Look, guys,
here we are.
A few episodes ago, we inadvertently did Father and Son Story Corner, because our friend Tom Barnard, he had a problem with voice control in a Mercedes, and then his dad had a story about a lawnmower with a highly tuned Speedway engine.
How could we ever forget?
So we've now had another. Well, we had basically a chap called Charlie sent us a message, a good story, and then his dad messaged, and we hadn't read out Charlie's story, which is very good, and I'll read it in a minute. And his dad told us an equally good story and then went, oh, by the way, you haven't read out my son's message yet. So I'll do them both because they're both very good stories. But Charlie's first involves his dad. He says his dad used to work for a housing association who once in a while would ask a chap to assist in financial matters. He was known as the consultant. He was a short but very jolly chap in his 40s who, politely speaking, was rather spherically challenged and was comfortably as wide as he was tall. As you may expect, the consultant had amassed a decent fortune over the years, very much reflected in his corpulence, much like Henry VIII gorging on 5 banquets in one sitting, to exude his wealth via his waistline. One day, the consultant was perusing supercars on offer at the nearest Lamborghini dealership. "What's that?" he inquired to the young salesman, gesturing flamboyantly at the brand-new Murcielago. At which point, the salesman, peering from behind the solar eclipse created by the consultant, simply replied, "I don't think that particular car would quite suit, sir." Perhaps an ingenious sales technique, because the consultant retorted by mouthing an expletive and immediately purchasing said supercar.
Immediately bought a Murcielago?
Immediately bought a Murcielago. So... Charlie says the consultant found himself consistently looking like a large panda performing a rare form of yoga in order to extract himself from his new supercar. As such, he contacted the dealership to say he would like to sell the Lamborghini back to them.
He just bought it almost as a quip to say to this bloke, listen,
to be defiant,
listen, I can afford that. Here, I'm going to buy it now. And then quickly realising he can't physically get in it.
Yes, or at least it's a struggle. It's a panda doing rare form of yoga to get in and out of it is a great description. So, Charlie says, while the car had barely been driven due to the rotundness of its owner, the Lamborghini dealership insisted on running a full inspection prior to its return. The consultant later received a phone call with the same salesman rather embarrassingly questioning whether the car had been in an accident. "Impossible," the consultant replied stoutly. Yet the salesman advised that this once beautifully designed piece of Italian-German engineering had suffered roof damage during its 3 weeks with the consultant.
What?
As it transpired, every time the consultant had attempted to weasel himself out of the low cockpit, he had grabbed onto the roof of the car between the A and B pillar in order to hoist himself out to freedom. Repeated actions with the consultant's substantial mass had caused the side of the roof to buckle, verging on being irreparable. This led to likely the fastest depreciating Lamborghini Murcielago in the southeast of England, given that the repair bill was enough to make even the consultant wince.
No way.
So, to sum up, a tubby, wealthy man buckled the roof of a Lamborghini with his own mass, trying to get in and out of it. Extraordinary. Thank you, Charlie, for that.
I don't know what to say to that.
It's amazing, isn't it? But since this is father and son corner, we now go from Charlie to his dad, Kevin, who sent us, this is a few weeks ago, Kevin had listened to the podcast where we, now this I think might have actually been the Patreon only podcast. Do you remember, which was so long ago you probably won't even remember this, because we recorded a show last year as a sort of spare show and then never used it, so we put it out over the Christmas period for patrons, and we were reading out a listener's message about his mum worked for a hire company in the 80s that used to hire out hot hatches, and they discovered that there was this guy who was renting hot hatches for the weekend and then doing rallies in them and stuff, road rallies,
Peugeot 205.
And it was an XR2 where he finally got busted because they lifted up the carpet and there were holes where a roll cage had been put in for the weekend.
I can't believe they'd done that. I mean, that's so dirty.
I know. Well, Kevin, Charlie's dad, he was up to this same caper back in the day. He says, love last night's bonus podcast. It brought back memories of doing a season of the Southwest Road Rally Championship in hire cars. Our go-to was Budget in Clifton, Bristol.
Oh,
back to Bristol again.
Back to Bristol.
But in the 80s, so before Bristol existed. Budget in Clifton, Bristol, who had 205 GTIs for £50 a weekend. But crucially, for an extra £3.50, collision damage waiver. We didn't need a roll cage or harness, just a light for the navigator and we were good to go. The season went well. The cars were fantastic. They got a little battered, but our £3.50 investment saved us. Plus, sorry we hit a badger was the excuse for the less than concourse condition on return. All went swimmingly until I called Budget as normal to book for the weekend. But they had discontinued the 205 as they were being abused by renters. Odd that.
Yeah.
I had to phone around, and Max Garage in Weston-super-Mare had a Clio available. Perfect. So with navigator Mark Milton, who went on to be an international navigator with Tony Pond in 6R4s. Bloody hell. We set off in the Clio for the rally starts somewhere on Exmoor. We signed on and were given the event's documents, which proudly thanked this year's sponsors for all their help and assistance. Max Garage in Weston-super-Mare.
Oh, sugar.
Keeping a low profile and our fingers crossed that no one would spot what we had done, we joined the queue for the first competitive section. But a few of our fellow competitors were sniggering and pointing at us. The reason became clear when we reached the start, to be flagged away by an extremely angry man. Yep, Mac of Mac's Garage Western Superman.
No way. He must have been absolutely so steaming. Good.
As soon as we finished the event, we rushed back to Mac's Garage, getting there in the early hours, dropped the car off, put the keys through the letterbox and fled.
You actually rallied.
Apart from not getting my deposit back, Mac left us alone, but that was an end to the hire car adventures and my rallying days.
Bloody hell. You naughty listeners. That's I mean, Exmoor is an epic place. That's my old stomping ground for driving, and it is wonderful. When I'm old, I might retire there. But yeah, imagine being the guy that owns the garage and innocently rents cars to people. In fact, it's being used in heavy competition. Heavy competition. Shit. Bloody hell.
That is fantastic. As an aside, Kevin was the chap who turned up to the Late Break Show in Leicestershire in the Aston DBS, which I do remember seeing there.
Yes, I do. It was an early riser car. It just appeared out of nowhere. Like a street magician had just sprinkled his fingers and it was just there. I was like, who bought the DBS? That's cool. I know. No, I remember that. Oh, well, what a story.
Kevin has sent us a fabulous story. He has a lovely Aston. Unfortunately, I hate Kevin to the very core of his soul because he heard me talking about Porsche 997 GT3 RSs and how it's my favourite car in the whole world.
Yeah.
And then he went out and bought one.
Oh, what an absolute...
And he sent us a picture.
What a flirtist.
It's that beautiful blue, which is quite an unusual colour on those. I can't remember what the actual name of the colour is, but it's a fabulous blue. It's kind of like almost the same colour as my old Jag I-Pace.
Well, he's barred from any future
late break banned, unless he's got a story. He's actually sent us a picture as well, which again, maybe I'll put up on the for patrons, of himself and his co-driver doing a road rally in a hired 205 GTI. It's fantastically 80s photo because it's at night and it's sort of a bit out of focus and soft in that way that nocturnal photography always was.
That's right, so it was
very atmospheric. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Charlie. Father and Son Corner has once again done us proud.
That's so good. That's so good.
That was on my list.
I never did anything quite as good as that. I did it. I think it was on Max Power or Revs magazine. We did a feature on these drift days, which were appearing out of nowhere in the early 2000s. And I decided we needed to do a sort of let's go mental, it's only a rental feature. And I went to Hertz and I found quite a well appointed 330 CI BMW. And I rented it and we put drift stickers all over it and I took it to a Drift What You Wrong Day at Silverstone.
Oh my God.
And didn't die and didn't crash and then gave it back. But and it, we just photographed all of that in how that panned out. But yeah, we certainly didn't go on a stage rally. I mean, bloody hell, that's quite hardcore.
The possibilities for clouting a gatepost.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Putting a very big dent in a welded-in part of the car.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I I salute the chutzpah of anyone who did that back in the day when such things were possible.
Do you know what? Back in the day, that is a term which back in the day, if you weld back in the day to and all that, I mean, I've heard that used a lot. And again, that might have to go in my cauldron of forbidden phrases. It's back in the day and all that.
Bloody hell. I had to talk to an estate agent the other day and it reminded me of something that is it's a low level but definite slight irritation for me is people who say in regards to a bit too much.
Okay.
Do you know that one?
Yes. Yeah.
Or with regards to.
Yeah.
And this bloke was like, so obviously, I will be in touch with regards to the likely price. But with regards to the shower cubicle, it definitely would need to be replaced with regards to the seals, which are leaking. And that could be, with regards to the water on the floor, that could definitely be the cause. But, with regards to the plumber, we'll definitely have to speak to him. And it's just like, stop saying, why is it meaningless? What the frig are you on
about?
There's
too many layers of regard now. It's far too many regards.
It's just like nothing. Stop regarding stuff. Prick. I've forgotten about that because I've encountered people who do that before and it's just a bit too much. It's like once or twice is fine, but stop saying it all the time.
Are you still liaising with this guy? Because you need to retort on that side of things and just see if he cottons on to the fact that you say on that side of things after every sentence.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, just
sort of like not fight fire with fire, but kind of fight bollocks with bollocks.
Oh, fight ticks with ticks. Absolutely.
Like kangaroos.
Yeah, just do it. Just throw an OTSOT at
Ticks.
It.
Tick Wars. Tonight on ITV, Verbal Tick Wars with Philip Schofield.
I was going to say, there's bloody game shows everywhere at the moment. We could do one. It'd be OTSOT, wouldn't it? I don't know what the rules would be.
It's a rival to the chase. It's on about 5 o'clock or something on a weekday afternoon. Actually, I did have an idea for a new game show the other day because it's a crowded market, the game show
world. It is
world,
heavy,
isn't it?
Heavy.
And there's a lot, but they're all fundamentally just asking questions. You need to find your gimmick.
Yeah.
That dollies that up a bit. Otherwise, you've just got a pub quiz on your hands. And so my idea is, it's called I Won't Repeat the Question with Ross Kemp. And the hook is, he will not repeat the question.
Well, no shit, yeah.
So he'll go, the Greek philosopher who wrote the epic poems Iliad and the Odyssey was who? Sorry, Ross, I didn't catch that. Could you repeat the question? No, I've told you, I won't repeat the question.
It's the point of the game show.
But sometimes he'll fuck with them. And he'll go, right, question three. And then just as he's about to start reading it, he'll just turn on a hairdryer.
Or his phone, or ring. Be a ringtone. Yeah. Really loud ringtone. Sorry about that.
Sometimes he just deliberately mumbles in the way that he used to on telly when he was acting. He'll start whispering a bit too much. So
he looks left and right before he says it. Like it's a secret.
But he'll really fuck with them because he'll do the first bit quite loudly. So he'll go, okay, question four. Henry VIII had 6 wives, but how many? I'm not sure. Sorry, Ross, could you repeat the question? I've told you! I won't repeat the question!
Stop it. You're making my nose run.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know, Ross. Is it London Bridge? No! Of course it's not London Bridge, you idiot.
He's so cross.
Or, he'll just suddenly a curtain will drop behind him as he's doing the question. There's a helicopter there or something, or someone playing kettle drums. In 1974, Brazil.
What, there's a Jamaican
capital.
Oil drum. It's the Jamaican oil drum band. Oh, gosh.
Ross, I didn't catch the middle of that. Could you repeat the question? How many times do I have to tell you people?
I was actually filming a barn find in Cardiff, so not that far from Bristol, last week. And in fact, the video's going to be on the Late Break Show by the time this podcast emerges. And I'd urge you all, with my non-biased head on, to watch it, because it's basically a garden full of hoarded, slimy, vandalised Porsches. But when we were filming, in the road next door to where this site was, I think it must have been a road that was quite popular for people wringing out their engines. There was so much second gear just like rinsing going on. It was, and we had to sort of pause filming and do it again. It's like, it's just too loud, you know. It was just so loud, and then overrun cackle, just liberal overrun cackle.
That's just reminding me. I was on London's North Circular Road last night, and a gentleman in a Porsche 991 Turbo, came alongside me. I was in my 911, and it was making the most extraordinary turbo noise. Like,
what, inhale or exhale?
Both.
Oh, okay.
But just also just kind of turbo whir. You know, when it's like it's got a snail on it, so big.
Yes.
That,
like Earth movers.
It sounded
do.
Like a spaceship.
That's quite like, and I quite like that Earth mover style. It's the turbo.
Yes,
it's like a turbo idle. Like it's going to inhale everything around it.
Industrial. It sounded industrial. And normally I'm kind of like, why have you done that? That was a nice car. But I kind of admired that. He'd obviously gone so extreme. And then he clearly saw me clocking him.
Yeah.
And he just, it's an average speed stretch of road, so you can't be an absolute anus. But he just briefly gunned it and then lifted off, and a load of flame came out the back.
Oh.
And I said to my wife, I don't think that car's standard. And she went, why has he done that? And I kind of hadn't got an answer, except that secretly I thought it was quite cool.
I was going to say, I mean, like you say, if it was an Audi S3, you'd think he was a bit of a spam dagger. But actually, in that instance, maybe it was acceptable. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it had quite a expensive private plate on it, but otherwise, it looked quite standard.
Did it have?
I could see.
Did it have a sticker in the back window saying "All eyes on me," but with Z's instead of S's?
Not that I noticed.
Okay,
but maybe
it was dark. Just checking.
In fairness, I couldn't. I think it was dark, so I couldn't tell for sure if he'd left it all looking standard on the outside. But it looked fairly standard to me. So
I can't compete.
Fair
with
play
that.
To you, sir.
It sounds cool. I can't compete with that.
Hey,
it was the Frontera man with the mouth breathing. That was the only recent observation, motoring observation I've had, which did make me laugh. It's a proper krill sifter.
Krill sifter.
It's a bearded, shall we say, country, rural looking man. And they live around here somewhere, because I see
a rural man.
I see this Frontera every week.
And is it a three door or a five door Frontera?
Oh, I think it's five.
Oh, gosh.
And the bloke driving it, quite bearded, and he was driving past us the other morning, which was very frosty, so I can only think that more concentration was being applied than normal when driving.
The mouth went to full gate.
Oh, the mouth was so fully open. It was incredible. And I was giggling. I nearly lost control of my car because I was watching him coming the other way with his krill sifter in.
He must like this time of year, though, because there's much less risk that a rogue wasp will come in through an open window and go straight into his throat.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, some cars, especially ones that don't get used so much or don't get cleaned very much, there are creatures that live in the cars. And there's a spider which lives in our chimney. And I've cleaned the chimney numerous times, and I don't actually know where it lives in the chimney.
Yeah.
But it comes out and it creates a web over the corners of the windscreen. So I'm thinking, this bloody spider's been living in the car for probably a year. But, like, people have got mucky cars where there's more chance of survival, should we say, crumbs, etc. There's like, you know, interior wildlife going on.
Yeah.
Captain Krill Sifter in the Frontera has probably got all manner of stuff.
Maybe that's it. Maybe he was raised by frogs and he's actually just catching flies in there for his breakfast.
He's a fly catcher. Yeah.
We should wrap this up soon, but before we go, there was one other thing I put on my list which we were going to talk about. It's just the last week's news about the death of Drive Tribe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which, I don't know, were you saddened by that?
Not really. I mean, I had the opportunity to work on Drive Tribe, but it was quite an unusual... When it first was conceived, a couple of guys I used to work with were employed on it. And actually, you the same, I know. And it seemed like a very exciting prospect, and I know there was an enormous amount of money being waved around. But I couldn't ever work out whether it was me not being very clever or whether I didn't fully understand how the concept was going to play out, because I realised quite early on they wanted me to be like a sort of figurehead of a certain community and things. And to
But
they didn't want to give me any money at all.
Yeah, I know.
And I was like, but I don't really understand. So why would I do that?
So much money was spent on that thing in the early days.
Yeah.
They had a very flash office in King's Cross. Did you go there?
No. No.
Oh, it was a really swishy office, and it was full of people as well. You're like, what's everyone doing? Because, you know, most of them were doing the tech behind the scenes, which apparently was very good and very state of the art. But it was a little bit confusing. I remember going to a meeting where they explained to me how it was going to work, and I couldn't quite get my head around it, in as much as it was like, is this sort of like social media, but it's not, but it's then they wanted editorial, so it's sort of like a traditional website, but they were very keen to impress it wasn't a traditional website, it was the next generation. And I don't think people like in the public ever quite got what it was supposed to be either. So it sort of became
a forum.
Yeah, just a forum. And I remember in the early days, it was like there were all these different tribes, and some of them seemed quite interesting, but it was very hard to know what was out there. And someone I work with said it feels like you're sort of trapped in a walled garden. You know there's more stuff outside, but you're not quite sure how to get there. So they did, and they evolved it, and they tried to make it more easy to find stuff and to sort of navigate generally. But then it did sort of just seemingly become, you're relying on users to generate content, which is only how a lot of YouTube exists.
Yeah, of course.
And
of
Twitter course. Is all user-generated content, and we all just sort of scroll through it. You know, that's how the internet works. But the bit that I hadn't really, I suppose, fully appreciated and started to come out last week once they announced it was closing down was all the people who aspire to write about motorsport or cars or something in that world who'd used it as a sort of shop window to what they could do, or as a way to sort of develop their skills by just doing it more. It's what I always say when people go, how do you become a writer? I just go, well, do writing, just write for your own amusement, because the more you do it, the better you'll get. And I think actually it turns out for a lot of people who want to write about cars, posting things regularly on DriveTribe allowed them to sort of figure out how to get better at it, even if they weren't being paid. It was just learning.
It was a springboard.
How to be as good as they could be, and then also in a public place, so they could go, hey, look, I've got this whole back catalogue here of stuff that shows what I can do, and that's all gone. So I hadn't realised that it sort of did play quite an important role in that respect. But anyway, I mean, it was just absolutely pissing money out the door, and they sort of, you could trace the decline of DriveTribe in their offices, which went from being a very flash place in King's Cross to a quite modest place behind a Volvo garage on a roundabout. And it sort of showed that I think they'd realised they couldn't just keep sluicing cash.
No. Well, I admire anyone that's trying something new and is willing to put their money where their mouth is, because it's a bold move and it's tough. I kind of got the impression that that Jeremy was having none of it pretty early on, I think.
He checked out pretty early, I think.
He checked out very early and obviously consequently went off and did farm-related matters. But I just felt a bit like it became clickbaity, because I think they realised to get big views, and views meaning income, was to just go a bit tabloidy with the with all the headlines. And it's and I understand why, you know, as a YouTuber, I understand why you would do that. But if you're trying to maintain some sort of integrity or keep your kind of your voice respected, it's hard to come back from that just by putting lots of exclamation marks in the title and, you know, we bought the world's worst car ever or whatever. Just seems a bit...
Well, I mean, that's, you know, I think places like Car Throttle have done quite well on that.
Yeah.
And so it's not, you know, it does work.
Do you think we should set up a website? Should Smith & Sniff be a portal now that Dribble Tribe is ending? Or do you think...
I don't know. Have you got 30 million quid hidden under that rug?
I'm just going to check. Hang on a minute. No, I've got... I might have enough money to buy a Reliant kitten. And that's probably about it. And the kitten wouldn't be roadworthy. So
set up an epoch-defining car portal.
Yes.
Or buy an unroadworthy Reliant kitten.
Yeah.
It's a tough choice.
Or that Mondeo trailer, which I...
No, we're not
on Facebook Marketplace, which is a place I don't go. I want everybody to know this.
What is wrong
with
you?
I get forwarded Facebook Marketplace bargains on a daily basis. And I don't go on Facebook. I'm a little bit scared of it. I've heard the marketplace is a treasure trove for automotive things. But and I'm tempted, but I don't want the baggage of association with Facebook. So, but this half a Mondeo, you know, people cut cars in half and then make them into novel trailers.
Yeah,
there's a half a Mondeo which looks like it's had stars airbrushed on it and a boot spoiler. And it's only 250 sheets, and it looks like the kind of trailer you'd have in a mobile disco that turns up at
Is that just for the trailer? I didn't check.
I think so. You don't get the car as well. We're living in a world where scrap cars are worth more than 200 sheets.
Yeah, it's true.
Come on, Richard. No, so I think it might be a good Smith & Sniff tour trailer if we ever did a tour. What do you think?
A homemade half a Mondeo trailer.
With stars airbrushed on it.
Why don't you make it the Late Break Show trailer?
No, we're higher end than that. But I think for Smith & Sniff it could be perfect.
Whereas this podcast very much isn't.
I'm going to set up a GoFundMe page for the half Mondeo trailer, although it's probably sold by now, because let's face it.
I think, hey, if we're setting up internet platforms, how about a rival to that called Go Fuck Yourself, in which you give money to people to make their lives worse?
It's a great idea.
Johnny wants to buy half a Mondeo trailer, which will become a blessed inconvenience because it's homemade shite.
Yeah, his wife is threatened. Why not give him some money? If he buys it, she'll leave. Yeah. So we bought it for him and we've put it outside his house.
Through GoFuckYou, the new online portal for spite and misery.
What about GoDaddy, the website provider? I always think if it was Go, comma, Daddy, would that mean, like, just go away? We don't want Dad around
anymore.
GoDaddy.
Yeah, my daughter says that to me sometimes. Go away, Daddy.
Yeah. Go, Daddy.
She's 4. I mean, although I'm sure she'll say it when she's 16.
She will.
Well,
it's the same narrative. It's just a different year.
Start them young. Anyway, well, we should wrap this up, and we should do it with me saying 3 things, as I usually do. The first is that Johnny has a solo YouTube channel called The Late Break Show. By the time you hear this, hopefully there'll be an excellent barn find / garden find video with some lovely / rotten old Porsches in it. 2, I've got various books out. The latest one is called Boring Car Trivia 3. It's packed full of boring car trivia. Of course,
it's not boring.
Says
it's not boring.
The front. Yeah, maybe in retrospect, too self-deprecating. Don't know. Anyway, too late now. And the third thing I've got to tell you is you may remember the band So Solid Crew from the early 2000s. They never heard of them in Bristol, but the rest of you probably have. And one of their members is called Lisa Mafia. But did you know that Lisa Mafia's real surname is Mafia? I always assumed it was a stage name to make her sound threatening, but no. She is of Italian descent on one side of her family, and her surname is Mafia, with 2 Fs.
Is it really Mafia? Wow.
Yeah, she is called Lisa Mafia, so, I mean, that wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even sort of posturing.
So Solid
stage.
Crew, wow, okay. Mm. With Romeo, wasn't there Romeo? Someone was called Romeo in it, I remember that.
Romeo, Asher D. I mean, well, actually, there were about 162 members, so it'd take us all day. And we have, much like them, only 21 seconds to go. So,
clever.
We better wrap this up by saying thank you ever so much for listening. We'll see you or speak to you again next week. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, and can you rate us? Can you give us a star rating? If you think that this is worth listening to, give us all the stars and just write.